Lawrence Cronin, Smith, Cassatine, and Jenkins, on behalf of the appellant. I'd like to introduce our co-counsel, Michael Friedman and Gene Scheer of Winston & Strawn. Mr. Scheer will present appellant's argument.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
With the court's permission, I have reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
This case could easily be resolved in one word, GWALA. Because the question here is so close to the question that the court resolved there just 4 years ago. Here the question is whether creditors of an insolvent limited liability company, or LLC, may invoke the equitable standing doctrine that this court recognized for regular corporations in GWALA. That is, that creditors of an insolvent corporation have standing to maintain derivative claims for breaches of fiduciary duties. Now, as you may have noticed in reading the opinion of the Court of Chancery, that court suggested that it disagreed with GWALA. It said reasonable minds can differ as to whether the outcome there was correct. And in fact, as I'll explain in a moment, the Court of Chancery's analysis is indeed contrary to GWALA in three specific respects that I'll mention. But let me begin with two issues that we think the Court of Chancery got right. First, it didn't deny that given that the company here is insolvent, that unless this creditor, our client, has standing to assert derivative claims, there's no one with the incentive and the ability to hold the managers of this LLC to account for breaching their fiduciary duties. And that, of course, is the whole reason for the derivative standing doctrine and the very concern that led this court in GWALA to recognize that in certain circumstances, creditors of insolvent corporations have standing to bring derivative claims. The second thing that the Court of Chancery got right was it correctly recognized that the language of Section 18-1002 does not squarely foreclose equitable standing for creditors of LLCs. Indeed, the court acknowledged that the phrase, quote, a derivative action, is susceptible of two different readings. One is that it defines the entirety of who may bring a derivative action on behalf of an LLC to the exclusion of all others. That is, that the word a means any of any kind whatsoever or any by anyone. The other reading that the court discussed is that the phrase a derivative action simply refers back to Section 18-1001 and thus excludes only a subset of the equity holders that are expressly permitted to sue under that section, and that it says nothing about other potential plaintiffs. Now, in adopting the broader reading of that preamble language, that is, a derivative action, we think the Court of Chancery ignored the settled principle that a word or a phrase in a statute is known by the company it keeps. That is, you have to look to the context. And I think the technical name for that canon of construction is nocitor associus. But that's the principle that we think the Court of Chancery ignored here. And let's look, then, at the context in which these words appear. And for me, it was helpful to actually put sections 1001 and 1002 on the same page and just kind of look at them together. But as you'll see, the phrase at issue here in a derivative action is the first phrase of section 18-1002. And if you look just above it to section 1001, that entire provision is focused just on members and assignees of LLCs. It says that it recognizes a right by a member or assignee to bring a derivative action. It says a member or an assignee may bring an action in the Court of Chancery if the right of an LLC to recover a judgment in its favor, subject to the standard demand and futility requirements. So again, that provision is entirely directed at members and assignees. And then if you look at the remainder of Section 18-1002, all of the text after in a derivative action, all of that text is similarly focused on members and assignees. And so if in light of that context, if you ask yourself, what does that phrase in a derivative action really mean? Does it mean any kind of derivative action brought by anybody in the world, or does it mean simply in a derivative action as described in the preceding paragraph? It seems clear to me, at least, that the better reading of the statutory text is that that phrase, a derivative action, means a derivative action of the sort described in Section 1001. Now, we don't have to establish that our reading of the statute is the better reading. We think it is right. We think it's certainly the better reading. But where we and the Court of Chancery agree is that the statutory language does not clearly foreclose a derivative action brought by a creditor of an insolvent LLC. So in that respect, this case is similar to Jiwala, because the pertinent statute here as there does not clearly foreclose creditor standing as a textual matter. But as I said, the Court of Chancery's analysis is contrary to Jiwala in three critical respects. First, Jiwala, along with this Court's more recent decision in Shoon, forecloses the Court of Chancery's assumption that a concededly ambiguous provision dealing with one kind of derivative claim can limit the Court's authority to recognize other kinds of derivative claims. As those decisions recognize, and as this Court has recognized for a long, long time, the Chancellor has inherent authority, if equitable considerations require, to grant equitable standing to any class of plaintiffs not already covered by a statute. As this Court put it in Shoon, even where, as was true there, a statute already covers the general subject, and I quote this Court there, the Court said, equitable doctrine can still be judicially extended to address new circumstances. And in fact, the Court went on and said, indeed, the Chancellor always had and always must have a certain power of adapting the doctrines which he administers. He can extend those doctrines to new relations and shape his remedies to new circumstances if the relations and circumstances come within the principles of equity. Accordingly, as the Court said in Shoon, and I quote again, the source of our equity jurisdiction forbids any statutory construction that would limit that jurisdiction, that is, the jurisdiction of the Chancellor, unless that intention is clear from the language of the statute. And in a way, that principle is similar to the principle that this Court applied more recently in a case called Olson versus Halverson, which also involved the LLC Act, in which this Court said, if the General Assembly wants to limit the application of the statute of frauds by excluding LLCs from the statute of frauds, it must say that explicitly. So there again, that's another example of a clear statement rule that we think quite clearly applies here. And again, as we've discussed, there's certainly no clear statement of intent in Section 1002 to restrict the Chancellor's ability to recognize additional derivative plaintiffs, as this Court did in Jiwala with respect to corporations.
If the General Assembly wanted to step in and codify this area and basically limit the derivative action plaintiffs, what language would they use other than, in a derivative action, the plaintiff must, and I emphasize the word must, be a member or an assignee of a limited liability company?
I think there are several ways they could do it. One way would be to say, in any derivative action brought by any plaintiff whatsoever. That would be explicit, and that would be clear. And that is the way the Chancellor seems to have interpreted the language. But that is not what the language says. It simply says, in a derivative action, which, for reasons we've discussed, I think can better be interpreted as simply a reference to the type of derivative action that's been articulated in Section 1001. The legislature could be even more explicit. They could say, you know, there shall be no derivative action allowed with respect to an LLC by anyone other than a member or an assignee as defined in Section 1001. They could do that. There are a number of ways that they could do it, but I submit that they have not done that clearly and explicitly here, especially when you understand those three words in their broader context, as we're required to do as serious textualists. Now, the defendants here argue in an analogous argument to the argument that the Court of Chancery adopted. They argue that these settled equitable principles are inapplicable to this case because they say alternative entities are creatures of statute, and hence the Chancellor's authority over them must also be a creature of statute. But that was true in Gwala as well. Corporations are likewise creatures of statutes created and governed by Title VIII of the Code, and that didn't prevent the court in Gwala from granting equitable standing to creditors there. And indeed, this court said in Shoon that derivative actions in general are creatures of equity and hence are unaffected in many cases, unaffected by the statute. And in fact, the General Assembly acknowledged in the text of the LLC Act that equitable principles would supplement the Act's provision. In Section 18-1104, for example, the statute says that in any case not provided for in this chapter, the rules of law and equity shall govern. And certainly this is a case that's not provided for in this chapter. There's no provision in this chapter for derivative actions by creditors. And therefore, under the plain language of 1104, those actions would be governed by the principles of equity. And again, the defendant's whole argument rests on the same fallacy that was rejected in Gwala and Shoon, that where some rights are provided by a statute, that the Chancellor's equitable power to deal with that subject must be found in the statute or not at all. And that simply is not the Delaware tradition. The second way in which we think that the Chancery Court's opinion departs from Gwala is its failure to recognize that all the policy considerations that led this court to allow creditor standing there also support creditor standing here. The most important reason for recognizing creditor standing in Gwala was the moral hazard that arises when a company is insolvent. As the court there noted, a corporation's insolvency makes the creditors, the principal constituency, injured by any fiduciary breaches that diminish the firm's value. Now, that's as true for LLCs as it is for ordinary stock corporations. As with stockholders in a corporation, a breach of fiduciary duty can't really harm the LLC's members, again, if the company is insolvent, since the members' investments are already worthless. And so, as with creditors of a corporation, the creditors of an LLC can be harmed by a manager's breach of fiduciary duty, since that breach can easily reduce the value of the assets that are within the company and therefore available to pay the creditors' claims. Next, as this court also noted in Gwala, when a corporation is insolvent, the creditors take the place of the shareholders as the residual beneficiaries of any increase in value to the enterprise. They become, in essence, the beneficial owners. And here again, that's as true for LLCs as it is for ordinary corporations. Once an LLC is insolvent, its members no longer benefit from an increase in value, but at least some creditor will likely benefit from such an increase, since there will be more assets with which to pay that creditor's claims.
All these policy arguments are very interesting, but shouldn't we assume that the General Assembly was aware of all of those when they chose the language they chose for the LLC statute? So what this case really boils down to is not what's the best public policy in regards to the relationship between creditors of an insolvent LLC and the members, but really what did the General Assembly intend when it passed the statute in the form that it did?
I think that is certainly one question, and for reasons...
Why isn't it the question?
Well, because under the Delaware tradition of equity, the legislature's authority over the powers and jurisdiction of the chancellor is to some extent limited, even by the Constitution. This court's decision in DuPont versus DuPont, for example, holds that that the General Assembly lacks power to deprive the Chancellor of authority that it had back when the first Constitution was adopted in 1792, or at least the first Constitution recognizing the Chancellor's authority.
But is there any significance to the fact that in 1792, or even as the case says, before the time of the separation in 1776, LLCs didn't exist? So that why would that doctrine even contemplate a similar relationship between LLCs and the members and corporations under Title VIII and shareholders?
I think that's a reasonable question. But in fact, the back in the 1700s, the principle that that was applied by the Chancellor in England was not specific to a particular kind of business organization. There were several different kinds of business organizations in existence there, but the rule in the court of equity in England was that number one, that directors or similar people who have responsibility for managing a business enterprise where there's a separation of ownership and control, they have fiduciary duties akin to those of a trustee, number one, and number two, the settled rule was that that the Chancellor has the authority to hold those directors to their fiduciary duties.
Okay, by analogy, then, you would suggest to us, I guess, that when this legislature provides that fiduciary duties can be eliminated by parties to the governing documents of an LLC, that the legislature has no power to do that because the Constitution invests in the Court of Chancery equity jurisdiction through the common law to modify the statute and continue to exercise whatever power it deems appropriate in determining the relative accountability of those managers to the member owners.
Yeah. I'm not making that argument.
I know you're not, but I'm saying by analogy, if you suggest to us that your earlier argument is the correct one, why isn't what I just said equally plausible?
Well, the core of the equitable power, the Chancellor's view that directors had fiduciary duties of certain types, that was his substantive legal view. But his view as to the scope of his authority was that if we assume those duties exist, then the Chancellor has the authority to enforce them essentially through whatever means are available to enforce them. And, of course, the derivative action got going simply as a means of putting the judicial machinery in motion. If there was a plaintiff out there who legitimately had an interest in the matter, that plaintiff was allowed to put the judicial machinery in motion on behalf of the corporation to enforce those duties against the corporation's managers. And so the authority of the Chancellor I found very interesting Professor Prunty's article on this issue, which cites a number of the old English Court of Chancery opinions. But his conclusion, which appears well supported in the early decisions, was that the governing principle of the Court of Chancery was not specific to the organizational form, to the form of the enterprise. It simply was that in a situation where managers have fiduciary duties, the Chancellor has the authority to enforce those duties in whatever manner the Chancellor can find at hand. And so that's the principle that we believe was carried into force in Delaware, and that's why there are, and this Court has recognized this in DuPont versus DuPont and other decisions, there are certain constraints on the General Assembly's authority. Of course, the Court is careful not to be too combative about that, and appropriately so. But there are certain constraints on the General Assembly's ability to curtail the Chancellor's authority.
Did you want to save the balance of your time? You wanted 7 minutes for rebuttal. You're down to six.
Yes, thank you. Let me just make one more point briefly before I save the balance of my time, and that is the third reason why we think the Chancellor's opinion departs from GWALA. When you look at the five specific reasons that the Chancellor gave as to why creditors don't really need the ability to bring derivative actions against insolvent corporations, every single one of those reasons that he gave would also apply equally to corporations. And so in the chancellor's decision, there simply is no serious effort to distinguish GWALA. And so we think GWALA controls here, that it should control, and for that reason, the decision below should be reversed.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. With the consent of other counsel, I will make the argument this morning on behalf of all defendants. At the outset, this case should be resolved on the plain language of 18-1002 of the LLC statute. And that was noted repeatedly by the court below at pages 1, 4, 6, and 12 of its opinion. And contrary to plaintiff's assertions in their reply brief and Mr. Shear's assertion today, the court below never said that the statute was susceptible of two readings. Mr. Shear is alone on that. He can't invoke some statement from the court below. Indeed, in the very pages that they rely upon in their brief, where they repeated that in their that concept in their reply brief, at page 18, the court characterizes NACUSL's model provisions from which the LLC provisions that we're looking at ultimately evolved as being the first example of an exclusive concept here, as distinguished from the Section 327 model, which is open-ended and which deals with corporations. So the court itself rejected the argument that has just been made about interpretation. And rightly so. Section 18-1002 is unambiguous. Under the heading proper plaintiff in big black letters, the statute reads that, quote, in a derivative action, the plaintiff must be a member or an assignee of a limited liability company interest at the time of bringing the action. And in the face of such an unambiguous statute, this court's role is limited to applying the literal meaning of the words of the statute. This court recently held in Ross versus State that a court is allowed to look behind the statutory language itself only if the statute is ambiguous. And over 50 years ago, this court held that departing from the literal meaning of a plain statute is rarely permissible and should be resorted to with the greatest caution. And I'll touch on a few of the exceptions they try to create in their reply brief as I go on. Court below heeded these well-settled principles and held that the plain language of Section 18-1002 limited standing to only a member or assignee, and that's at page 7 of the opinion. Further, the court's reading of the plain language was bolstered by its review of cases and secondary sources that have interpreted comparable language and reached the same conclusion. In the Magden case in the U.S. District Court here in Delaware, a similar claim from a creditor seeking to bring suit derivatively on behalf of a Montana LLC was addressed. The Montana LLC statute has almost identical language to the Delaware LLC Act, and the Magden Court analyzed whether the creditor had standing under the LLC Act and concluded under the statute that a derivative claim may be brought only by a member of the company who was a member at the time of the transaction at issue. And similarly, the court has interpreted analogous language from the Limited Partnership Act as barring derivative standing to a constituency not specifically granted standing in the statute, i.e., holding twice, the Court of Chancery holding twice, that this construct was exclusive. In the Vanderbilt Income case, the assignee of a limited partnership interest attempted to bring a derivative action on behalf of the partnership. And at the time, neither the LP Act, which at that point I believe was the only one existed, the LLC Act hadn't come into place yet. That didn't come into place until 1992. The LP Act did not provide derivative standing to assignees. It only addressed standing for partners. And like Vice Chancellor Laster in this case, the Court of Chancery interpreted the LP Act's grant of standing as being exclusive and held that, since, quote, since plaintiffs are not limited partners, they may not bring a derivative action. And then that happened again in UH Acquisition, where the court held that the assignee of a limited partnership interest lacked standing under the grant of derivative standing in the LP Act. Later, the legislature did what I guess they could do here in theory. Later, they amended the exclusive provisions, an amendment which wouldn't have been necessary under the theory that's just been expressed. They amended it to add assignees, and then they basically took the same construct from the LP Act and it's in the LLC Act, and so now we have members and assignees as those who are the only ones who can bring derivative suits under the present LLC Act. Those cases,
hypothetically, if members of an LLC basically misappropriate all of the assets to the detriment of a creditor. The bottom line, from your view, legally, the General Assembly intended that there is no remedy that the Chancellor can impose by way of a, or allow by way of a derivative action by the creditor.
Not by a derivative action. There are other remedies. They range from all sorts of things, fraudulent conveyance, you've got bankruptcy, you've got all the provisions.
But do we have to rely on the federal government to provide a remedy for Delaware companies or Delaware creditors?
In the case of an insolvent company in that circumstance,
yes,
you may have to do that. As distinguished from a derivative action, there are all sorts of other types of actions that that theoretically could be brought depending on the facts. But if you simply say, we're talking about an insolvent corporation, we're talking about a breach of fiduciary duty, there's been nothing contractually that expands the rights of the creditor, which the Act permits, because it's a self-ordering contractarian concept, yes, you could end up in a situation where the recourse was to the federal bankruptcy court, which is, of course, part of the law of the land and something that one wouldn't ignore.
Doesn't a great deal turn on whatever the documentation is for the creditor's original loan? Don't creditors generally try to protect themselves from those eventualities, perhaps to the degree of requiring members to pledge their personal assets in support of the loan?
Absolutely. And as Vice Chancellor Laster pointed out in the latter pages of his opinion, there's also all sorts of flexibility built into the LLC Act, which would allow a creditor, certainly a creditor loaning the amount of money that these people loan to the company, to come in and insist on all sorts of protections. They could even throw out management if they got the contractual right to do that. They can do all sorts of things. It's a contractual concept. It's not the corporate concept that many of us have practiced. It's a different structure, and different rules apply. And in this instance, the legislature chose to say, in light of all of that flexibility, we're not going to give derivative standing to creditors.
Can I interrupt to make sure I understand? Is it your position then that either the LLC document itself could specifically provide that, notwithstanding the statute, creditors are have standing to bring a derivative action in the following circumstances, including insolvency?
You could certainly do that under 18107.
Okay, yes. And likewise, the credit conveyance, whatever form it took, could specify the rights of the creditors, which could include, notwithstanding the language in the LLC statute, the ability to bring a derivative action.
I think you could do that, or you could craft something that would be very similar to that. I mean, creditors have all sorts of default type provisions that they can draft in those documents.
Could the creditors negotiate for an assignment as part of their protection from the member, and that in the event of an insolvency there would be an assignment crafted that would give them standing even under the statute?
I think they can do that. Yes, Your Honor. And clearly the provisions that are pointed out in the enabling provisions in Section 18, and I thought it was interesting to go back and look at these, but they're the ones that are mentioned by Vice Chancellor Laster as he ticks them off. But the most important one is 18-1017, which provides that in your operating agreement, you can extend any rights you want to a creditor, to persons not parties to the operating agreement. And that ought to include the right, certainly, to be able to bring a derivative suit if you so choose, or something that you would characterize as or describe contractually as the equivalent of a derivative suit.
One could perhaps argue that the underlying concept of freedom of contract, which is expressly stated in the LLC statutes, proposed to create an arena of predictability, not one subject to the length of the Chancellor's foot down the road when things didn't go the way some parties thought they might.
I think that's right, Your Honor. Leaving aside, we've got the plain language. There's no second reading The court, Your Honors, all know that our legislature would be shocked to know that the Supreme Court could change literal plain language. And so in their reply brief, but not really what I heard this morning, there are a series of other arguments that are made along that seek to avoid the plain language rule. One is that they say that in the primary one in the reply brief is that a derivative standing is an equitable rule to exist that exists to prevent a complete failure of justice and that there is a presumption against legislative overriding of such a common law equitable rule. And that rests, of course, on the fundamental misconception that derivative standing in an LLC was created at common law, not by the LLC Act itself. But we all know that the LLCs are a creature of statute. We know they didn't even exist at common law. They are not only statutory creatures, but they are contractarian creatures. You always have trouble with that word, but they are a nature of contract. And indeed, the Court of Chancery has held on more than one occasion that the right to bring a derivative suit is created by statute in the LLC context. And indeed, the LLC Act itself, Section 1001, it speaks under the heading, quote, right to bring action, close quote, provides that a member or assignee has the right to bring a derivative action on behalf of an LLC. It creates the right, and then 1002 legislatively limits the right that the legislature created. And even if you thought somehow there was a common law concept that underlay all this, you can't deny that the legislature has codified this, which, again, it takes away the whole common law underpinning of this concept of having to show that it was clear.
Part of their argument, as I understand it, was even if they have codified it, that that basically restricts the powers of the chancellor in an unconstitutional way.
But that falls also because there were no LLCs back at the time that we separated or the country became independent or 1792, which I think is the other key date here. That LLCs are statutory creations. They were created in 1992. There was nothing of the nature of an LLC before 1992, and so there was nothing no equitable powers that the Court of Chancery had or didn't have prior to that date. So the constitutional argument falls for the same reason that this clear standard isn't the one that applies.
Their argument is it's a business entity, so the form of the business entity doesn't matter. It's the argument that the chancellor has the power to prevent a failure of justice.
Yeah, and I think the concept that the form of business entity doesn't matter in this state would come as a great shock to all of those who read our opinions and care about them. It does matter, and this was a new form of entity. There were no LLCs when you, Your Honor, or I started practice. They came into being in 1992, and this idea that there's some concept of a business entity other than a corporation to which there was some equity power that had already attached is just unsupported and I think unsupportable, Your Honor.
I think it's appropriate to discuss the what I see as a theme in some of the Court of Chancery cases, that it's because, well, let me put it this way. It's not because LLCs and LPs are statutory creatures that didn't exist at common law. They still create a fiduciary relationship.
Yes.
So long as they create a fiduciary relationship, no matter what their governing documents say or no matter what the statute says, there's some form of residual inchoate power that the Court of Chancery has to adjust bad results in favor of the party who seems to have been harmed or seems to have been deprived of an opportunity to seek an equitable remedy. Now, is there? I wouldn't focus on the business form, but the relationship of someone managing assets of another in the shareholder context in a corporation, but in a member-assisted drafted LLC document. Is there some meaningful way to discuss the difference in the fiduciary relationship? Or even is it a fiduciary relationship?
Well, I'm not even sure. I mean, I'm not even sure it is a fiduciary relationship. We all know that it could be. You could draft it that way. But we all know that These forms of statute, and I think the colloquy that went on earlier was informative about, do you mean that the provisions that the legislature adopted limiting fiduciary duties, which implicitly would limit the powers, certain powers that the Court of Chancery otherwise would have had in alternative entities, was unconstitutional? And I think everyone came to agreement that they weren't. And the reason they aren't is because you can shape those duties and shape who can take advantage of them in the alternative entity context, and that's exactly what the legislature has done here. I mean,
what happened in this particular LLC? Have they been shaped in that form?
Could a
member bring a breach of a fiduciary?
No.
Under the charter?
Oh, could a member? Could a member?
Right, under the
There's an exculpatory provision on money damages. It's drafted rather unusually. It's the equivalent of the 102b7 type provision that we see in the corporate area. But this particular one says that you won't be liable for duty of loyalty breaches or gross negligence breaches. And so it was unusually drafted to not protect against the one thing that those types of provisions normally protect against. So in this case, you can have a breach of fiduciary duty claim on a duty of care, gross negligence basis.
Okay.
The second argument that they make is somehow that the legislature, this was a grammatical error, and the legislature wasn't thinking about all this at the time that they passed this. And I think that's just not right. Let me drop back. The speak clearly concept, as I mentioned, is a concept that arrives if you think that this was a common law provision as distinguished from a statutory provision. So the first answer to that is it's a statutory provision, not a common law provision, for all the reasons we've just discussed. The second answer is it does speak directly and clearly to the subject. I mean, how more clear can you be than you must be a member or an assignee? You can't be clearer. You don't need anything. I mean, that's the clearest, plainest English language you could possibly have. And third, their arguments ignore the history of the drafting of these statutes, which Vice Chancellor Laster went into in detail and we've outlined in our briefs. But very briefly, in 1973, the Limited Partnership Act, as it existed in Delaware, had in it something that was similar to Section 327, which in the corporate area, which is open-ended and is not exclusive and doesn't speak to the question of who has standing. It just addresses what hoops a stockholder plaintiff in a derivative suit has to go through. And then our court had a choice. And when the 1976 version of the Limited Partnership Act came forward, it had the exclusive language. And that's what was opted for. And then that got carried over into the LLC statute. And the idea that they expressed that this was mindless, I would think would come as a great shock to all of us who have any understanding of what our system in here is. You had a choice. You could use the 327 model. You could use the RUPA model. They chose the RUPA model. We all know that these things all get vetted by the Bar Association before they go to the legislature. The idea that this just slipped through or people weren't looking at this, if this court were to say that it was a mindless thing, I think would come as a great shock to all of those who read our opinions. The presumption is that the legislature knows what it's doing when it uses the words. Frankly, that's the reality. They've offered nothing but speculation to the contrary. And finally, their last argument is probably the hardest one, and maybe that's why we didn't hear it in oral argument this morning, but it's in the reply brief, so I would take another minute or two to respond to it. And that is, they say that The plain language of the LLC Act should not be followed because it creates an absurd distinction between LLCs and corporations. But as the court below noted, there isn't anything absurd about different legal principles applying to corporations and LLCs. All sorts of different legal principles apply. Indeed, in Twin Bridges, the Court of Chancery noted that the conceptual underpinnings of the corporation law and Delaware's alternative entity law are different, and therefore cautioned against uncritically grafting corporate concepts onto alternative entities. And as we've already touched on, the Vice Chancellor then went through an extensive list of all the flexibilities that creditors have in the LLC construct. And I would commend your honors to read those portions of the court's opinion again that deal with 18-1017, 18-306, the right to seek specific penalties or expel management, the possible right of creditors to expand the legal duties of management, 18-1101C, the right to condition the approval of LLC amendments on creditor consent, 18-302E, the right to seek appointment of a receiver by a creditor, 18-805, plus wholly apart from all the other legal mechanisms that creditors have, fraudulent conveyance, bankruptcy law, replevin, sequestration, constructive trust, equitable liens, garnishment. Put simply, the derivative suit is far from the only tool creditors have to protect their investment and enforce duties to the LLC, and there is certainly nothing absurd, which is the standard that they would have to meet to create an ambiguity here, if you will, about not giving them the right to sue derivatively in this different structure. And there's also a discussion in the opinion where Vice Chancellor Laster quotes provisions or quotes discussions at a sort of another level in terms of the evolution of this law from decisions of Vice Chancellor, maybe by now he's Chancellor Stride, I'm not quite sure exactly when the confirmation hearing is. And it's explained there are two different paths you could go here, even in the corporate context. But certainly in the LLC context with its different approach, this approach is certainly not an absurd one. And again, I can't see this court in effect writing an opinion telling our legislature that their judgment here on this point was absurd. It's probably the hardest standard I think I've ever seen as a standard of review. And the reason for that is, of course, is that as your honors are well aware and have demonstrated repeatedly over the years, our court's job is not to decide policy questions, not to legislate, if you will, except in common law, except in places where the common law is developing. And here, on this narrow question of standing, the legislature has spoken. If your honors have any other questions, happy to answer them. My yellow light is on, but I guess I have 2 minutes and 10 seconds. I could answer any other questions the court had.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I find it interesting that Mr. Sparks hasn't disputed several of the key points that we just discussed earlier. First, he hasn't disputed that there is no other adequate remedy here to enforce the fiduciary duties that the managers here are alleged to have. Remember, this case arises at the pleading stage. The pleadings allege that there were fiduciary duties and that they were breached. And the other side doesn't dispute that there's no other way of enforcing those duties here. Counsel also has not disputed that all of the policy reasons that were discussed in GWALA for extending the derivative action to creditors of an insolvent corporation also apply equally to LLCs. That has not been disputed at all. And to the extent that counsel has disputed the comments that I made earlier, their arguments merely illustrate, in my mind, the lack of any sufficient basis for distinguishing GWALA. Let's talk about the statutory language for a minute. What the defendants offer this court is not genuine textualism, but a simplistic literalism that has been criticized by well-respected jurists across the spectrum, which is you simply take a small phrase out of context and say, what does this small phrase mean if we didn't know anything about the surrounding text. And that's the argument that the Vice Chancellor adopted, and the argument that's been made here. But as we discussed earlier, if you look at that phrase in context, it is quite clear that that phrase, in a derivative action, is simply referring to the kind of derivative action that's discussed in Section 1001 and then is discussed later in Section 1002. But at a minimum, it doesn't clearly foreclose a derivative action in this context. excuse me. There was some discussion about fiduciary duties, and as I mentioned, this case arises at the pleading stage, and they've been fiduciary duties have been alleged here. But it's also important to remember that the LLC Act does not completely eliminate fiduciary duties. It does give the parties some freedom to cut back on some fiduciary duties that would otherwise apply in the corporate setting. But the LLC Act also says that the duty of loyalty cannot be restricted in an LLC agreement. And here, we have alleged a breach of the duty of loyalty.
I'm sorry, can you give me the reference to the statute that says the duty of loyalty cannot be restricted by contrast with the party's contractual right to eliminate fiduciary duties?
That's my understanding. I don't have the reference at the top of my head, but if with the court's indulgence, I will send that in a letter. But assuming that I'm right about that, and that is my understanding of the LLC Act, we have alleged breaches of the duty of loyalty, and in fact, our complaint talks about some self-interested transactions in which managers of this insolvent company sold assets of the company to other companies that they controlled at fire sale prices. And so that would certainly be a breach of fiduciary duty if it were proven.
As far as the limitations or elimination of fiduciary duties for this particular LLC, what is your understanding of any limitation?
Well, my understanding is that the fiduciary duties were not limited. My understanding is that there was nothing in the agreement that limited those duties. But again, this case arises on the pleadings, and we have alleged both the existence of fiduciary duties and breach of those duties. And so as the case comes to the court, those allegations control. Obviously, there would be an opportunity for discovery and for a determination at some later point whether there were, in fact, any such duties and whether they had been breached. There was some discussion about the uniqueness of LLCs, and certainly they, in some respects, they are a new kind of animal, but mainly in the respect that they are treated as partnerships for tax purposes, many of the same concepts that apply to ordinary corporations obviously apply to them. There was also some discussion about freedom of contract, and we would submit that all of the freedoms cited by the Court of Chancery and the defendants here are available in the context of an ordinary corporation. And we've discussed that in our briefs, but that is not a basis for distinguishing Juwala. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.